Hi, and welcome back to Radio New Bloom. I'm your host, Garrett D. Now that the U.S. presidential election is over, people all over the world are looking at how the end of the Trump era might shift the winds of global politics. Taiwanese are no different, and my guest today is Catherine Cho, a professor of medieval and early modern history at Grinnell College in Iowa, and a prominent member of the online community advocating for a future that recognizes Taiwan's right to peace and self-determination. Catherine and I go over the reactions of Taiwanese and Taiwanese diasporic communities to the election, examining some of the ideological cleavages that separate different generations and populations. We also go over the effects that misinformation can have when talking about these issues, and whether or not this has contributed to the rise of right-wing sentiment among Taiwanese, a claim that is sometimes thrown around by certain leftist organizations, but fails to capture the complexity of social discourse in Taiwan, which contains a multitude of differing voices and opinions, all while living under the shroud of an existential threat of violence. Today's episode features a variety of viewpoints, and I think it's important to be clear that the situation can look radically different depending on where you're standing. While inevitably there are certain positions that we don't agree with, I think there was a fair amount of stepping into others' shoes in this episode that really generated understanding about what people value and how they express that socially and politically. It's also important to note that no one group or nation is a monolith. And while certain ideological trends are noticeable depending on backgrounds, there's a myriad of viewpoints that would be impossible to capture in a single episode. We certainly go over quite a few of them here. I learned a lot, and I hope that you all enjoy this episode. All right, everyone. I'm on today with Catherine Cho. Welcome to the show, Catherine.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on.
Absolutely. So would you go ahead and introduce yourself for our listeners who might not be familiar with you?
Sure. My name is Catherine Cho. I am a professor of medieval and early modern European history at Grinnell College in Iowa. So my day job is largely unrelated to Taiwan, but I grew up as a second generation Taiwanese American in a very intensely political household. And so I've been involved in advocacy for Taiwan from a young age. And in recent years have tried hard to just to understand Taiwan more, have more firsthand experience with it. And so about 5 years ago, I started this Twitter account. And I was really interested in trying to do whatever I could, a small role in trying to shift the narratives about Taiwan and to improve kind of mainstream understanding of the place and also myself to learn more about it. And as a result, in the last couple of years, I have done a little bit of public facing writing and education on Taiwan topics, also teach about Taiwan, early modern Taiwan, 17th century Taiwan in my global history classes as well. I'm not a professional, I'm not an expert, I'm just somebody who is really interested and has been fortunate, very fortunate to learn so much from people who are experts and who do this work for a living.
That's great. And I want to use some of that personal experience and the work that you do online to talk about some of the things that we want to know when it comes to the understanding of Taiwan. I really like that you use that phrase because today's episode, I think we really want to focus on the ways that Taiwanese society and U.S. society, and that includes Asian American society as well, understand some of the dynamics that are going on, particularly around the results of the U.S. presidential election, but then also in the greater political and social sphere between the two places. So happy to have some of that personal insight there too. So diving right into one of the big topics in the media, of course, being the U.S. presidential election. You've talked a lot about online some of the sentiment in Taiwan concerning the election, particularly some of the concerns that the results have provoked in some Taiwanese media and societal circles. This being that the change in administration from the Trump era to a potential Biden presidency would be maybe something that would work against Taiwan's interests in some way. The feelings that Taiwan might have been slighted in the past by members of the Obama administration, which Joe Biden, of course, was a part of, and the Democratic Party in general. Interestingly enough, there's even been some pro-Trump sentiment that has surfaced in some of the discourse around election fraud. Claims that have been picked up by the Taiwanese media that have, you know, been debunked by U.S. electoral and judicial officials, including that there was widespread election fraud or that somehow the results of the U.S. presidential election are invalid. What do you think are the roots of this sentiment in Taiwan, and where do you think a lot of this feeling is coming from?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. I would say that there's probably three kind of convergent factors at play. So first, definitely the Trump administration and its actions, its messaging, has made many Taiwanese feel seen and feel valued, especially in comparison to the relative neglect that they felt under 8 years of the Obama administration. So there had been this fervent wish, I think, among many Taiwanese for Trump to win a second term and for a repeat of the upgraded ties of the last 4 years. And this kind of morphed very quickly just over the course of that election week into a belief among some Taiwanese that the election had been stolen from him. And connected to this, I think, is a lack of familiarity about the complexities of the U.S. voting process, a belief that the relative simplicity and security of the Taiwanese system means that the U.S. one is by default insecure. I think that's one kind of really important factor, just the excitement about the gains that were made in U.S.-Taiwan relations under Trump, and that kind of shading into a sort of wishful thinking that the election results had been different. I think a second one, this is something that I picked up from an article in The Atlantic by Helen Lewis last month, titled "The World is Trapped in America's Culture War," which is this phenomenon not just in Taiwan, but elsewhere around the world, people outside the United States, because we're all utilizing this internet that the US engineers and designers created, that people end up absorbing American frameworks, partisan divisions, and information and kind of misinformation wholesale. So again, this problem, I think, of disinformation about the US election is not just something that we're seeing in Taiwan, even though I think there's probably a greater proportion of people in Taiwan who supported Trump than in other countries. And I think the third is sort of the inverse of the second phenomenon, which is mapping Taiwanese political cleavages onto the American situation. So, of course, the dominant political cleavage in Taiwan is about China and whether to not even just kind of pro or anti-unification, but how close to be to China and how kind of fervently to resist. I think because of how much that China cleavage really warps Taiwanese politics and politicking, there can be this tendency to think that the rest of the world, the US, is really also kind of obsessed with this question about what to do about China. You can see on when it came to certain green Taiwanese groups, for instance, so Taiwanese groups that are traditionally more pro-Taiwan sovereignty, sort of associating that political stance with the Republican Party in the US and associating the Kuomintang, this kind of pan-blue camp in Taiwan, that has traditionally been more open to a relationship with China that could potentially lead to annexation, for example, and associating the KMT with the Democratic Party in the United States, even though this China cleavage is nowhere near as powerful a force in American politics.
And I certainly don't think that the divisions map as cleanly as some people would think, where it, we can map, you know, sort of one-to-one the Kuomintang's views onto the Democratic Party and the Pan-Green's views onto the Republican Party. It is a little more nuanced than that. But this is something that we've seen too, not just in Taiwan. It's interesting that you bring this up because we've talked about this before with some of the Hong Kong movements as well. Is the dangers of Trumpism and sort of that clean mapping of, hey, this party is anti-China and thus must be, you know, sort of pro-Hong Kong. And on the flip side, something to say, well, you know, any enemy of China is necessarily a friend of Taiwan. Would you say that something like that is going on in this situation as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think you're right that it is a very dangerous oversimplification to try to make that one-to-one mapping. So pan-green, pan-blue, Republican, Democrat, especially because support for Taiwan within the US context, there's all of these different players, and there's variation in the policies that each presidential administration pursues. So people in Taiwan remember, for example, Bill Clinton's kind of three no's, this sort of pledge not to support Taiwanese independence, for example. But this is the same Bill Clinton who also sent during the 1996 Taiwan Straits crisis, who sent aircraft carriers through the Taiwan Strait in order, as a show of force, to say that the Taiwanese presidential elections, which were about to take place, should be allowed to do so peacefully. So I think there's great variation within potentially great variation between and in the policies that each U.S. presidential administration pursues, and that's reflective, I think, of divisions between advisors, because the U.S. is a democratic republic. You're going to have advisors that speak with different voices and have the upper hand at different times. Or are kind of on the back foot at different times. And then also the US Congress support for Taiwan there has historically been very bipartisan. And some of the most prominent voices speaking out on behalf of Taiwan, Sherrod Brown, for example, Brad Sherman, Ed Markey, who just won a very tough primary challenge from a scion of the Kennedy family. These are all Democrats, and they have been some of the longest serving members of the US Congress and also the most vocal on behalf of Taiwan. I think what we're seeing in Taiwan, again, and I want to really emphasize that Taiwan is in some ways an aberration, but in many ways not, in its response to Trump and the way that Trumpism has kind of manifested here. So that you see this in the US as well, that the negative things that Trump says about a certain group oftentimes don't seem to stick, even with the group that's being targeted. And so the negative comments that Trump has made about Taiwan, for example, this is reported in Ambassador John Bolton's book, that Trump compared Taiwan, you know, to the tip of a Sharpie and China to the this massive resolute state desk. And so, you know, this is supposedly a direct quote from Trump belittling Taiwan. And yet that doesn't seem to have a lot of traction here. And, you know, people didn't seem to be extremely upset about a remark like that. Whereas other remarks that Democratic advisors have made, for example, Jake Sullivan's kind of infamous email to Hillary Clinton while she was Secretary of State, a column that was published by Paul Kane as a New York Times editorial entitled, you know, "To Save Our Economy, Ditch Taiwan." And Sullivan had passed this along to Hillary Clinton. I know that Brian Hugh wrote about this in a New Bloom editorial that, you know, it's really hard to tell. This is a very short email. Is he sarcastic? Was, you know, what's the tone of this, right? Was this ever kind of a serious policy proposal or just kind of a joke? People here in Taiwan really remember that. And so I think this is the same kind of phenomenon that political observers in the US have really been grappling with, which is that Republican messaging and actions can often be quite hypocritical. And yet somehow those negative associations don't seem to stick in the minds of voters or people who support Trump. Whereas the missteps, the missteps or the less than kind of ideal statements by Democratic officials really seem to gain a lot of traction.
So it sounds to me, going back to that framework that we brought up before about the world being caught in America's culture war, seeming to me that the reality does not match the rhetoric here, which is a constant problem with Trumpism. Even the idea that Trump is tough on China in some way is debatable. We've seen Trump pretty much cede a lot of the gains that activists in Hong Kong have made, for example, to the Chinese government without putting up much of a fight. But yet, despite these actions, as you mentioned earlier, none of it ever seems to stick. He seems to persuade a large segment of people just with his rhetoric alone, even when the actions don't necessarily match up. And a lot of that gets reinforced through the media and through some of the misinformation that is amplified coming from the Trump administration through the media. And not just in the United States, but all over the world. You've mentioned before how Taiwan has long been a target of misinformation and of fake news. In general, in the Taiwan context, where do you think that the misinformation that you're talking about is coming from? And what are the effects that it has on the social discourse? And do you think that this in any way could be combated through action in Taiwanese civic society?
There's this astounding statistic from the Digital Society Project. They had a report in May 2019. And so they're run by the same people who run the Varieties of Democracy Institute. So they came out with this report in May 2019 that listed Taiwan and Latvia as the countries that are most affected by foreign governments' dissemination of false information. Of course, in Taiwan's case, that's from the Chinese government. And then also in May 2020, there was a Double Thinks Lab report, and that's the organization that's headed by Puma Shen. And they called the report the Chinese Infodemic in Taiwan because it specifically kind of looked at false information around the coronavirus pandemic. And they noted that that some of these narratives and cases that they looked at there are clear traces of coordinated efforts, and that the modes of dissemination in these kind of information operations would sometimes begin with posts on Weibo, for example, and then this is transmitted into content form articles. It's picked up by Chinese news media, and then it's kind of published and quoted and circulated in Taiwanese traditional media, social media, chat groups like Line, for example. So I think we can definitely see that like significant sectors of Taiwanese politicians and civil society have really evolved to be like hyper aware of threats coming from the Chinese Communist Party and to be skeptical of official pronouncements from different levels of the Chinese government. So then I think there's this question of whether, having evolved to counter misinformation from the CCP, Taiwan has sort of become maladapted to other challenges around misinformation. So where is the misinformation about the US election coming from? And this is really just my anecdotal observation, and I hope that like Taiwan Fact Check Center, for example, or US Taiwan Watch, which I cannot recommend enough, will undertake more systematic studies. So I think that this misinformation, from my observations, kind of coming from about four sources. One sort of what Renee DeResta from the Stanford Internet Observatory, which has also produced reports on the circulation of Chinese disinformation in the Taiwanese context. She calls this the right-wing, quote, demi media, intensely partisan outlets like Newsmax or One American News Network that amplify these ideas that bubble up from internet message boards. And so Taiwanese netizens have kind of entered into this information ecosystem at a moment when right-wing media has become even more fractured in the United States, and with lesser known outlets kind of competing to outflank even Fox News or Breitbart. So I think Taiwanese netizens have kind of entered at this particularly critical moment of like fracturing, and then also of like the acceleration of misinformation. That's one. Two, a kind of lack of skepticism among some Taiwanese about information that's sourced from prominent Chinese dissidents and their publications. So Epoch Times has been cited. And so their affiliates like New Tang Dynasty Television, for example, China Uncensored, which they have like millions, like 1.29 million and 1.48 million viewers on YouTube, subscribers, respectively. And they've got traditional Chinese outlets and translations as well. And so this, of course, is the network that's run by the Falun Gong, a kind of new sort of upstart competitor with that, Guo Linggui, Miles Kwok. Nick Aspinwall recently had this great article about GTV, Guo TV in foreign policy. This is also Miles Kwok is also Steve Bannon's kind of multi-millionaire, billionaire, like sort of sponsor in a way. So they in particular have been a very fertile ground for misinformation about Hunter Biden, about Joe Biden's son, and his alleged kind of business dealings in China. Also some kind of QAnon adjacent, like really nasty rumors, like about his sex life, for example, that kind of shade into this QAnon idea of like a powerful cabal of democratic pedophiles. So what's interesting to me about this really so much is that if this information, if these outlets were publishing information that seemed to be kind of, you just on a very surface level, like suspicious about Taiwanese politics, that you would see kind of more immediate kind of pushback from netizens here or civil society here, a recognition that maybe we shouldn't trust publications that are run by Chinese publishers when they're saying things that seem suspicious about Taiwan. We need to really like look into this. But because I guess this is the US election, there is not as much of a basis of knowledge about US electoral procedures or what is legal, for example, under US law. And so that's kind of alarming to see. And then I think then there's this sort of third order in which you'll see like reports from One American News Network, for example, or from GTV kind of repackaged and shared on social media by Taiwanese accounts. And again, this kind of lack of skepticism about information regarding the US or US politics that's coming from simplified Chinese language accounts that may be very anonymous. And so I think in conversations with Taiwanese people that I may disagree with, one point of commonality that I've tried to reach is to say, you know, Taiwanese people should be skeptical of anonymous, simplified language, Chinese language accounts, because, you know, we don't really know. These same accounts later on may share disinformation about Taiwan, and that could be quite dangerous to Taiwan. So it may or may not matter at all that Taiwan, like many other places around the world, was kind of suffused for this moment in time with misinformation about the US election. That may have no impact in the long term on US-Taiwan relations or anything of such great import. But, you know, these accounts, potentially, because again, you know, it's sometimes hard to tell who they're really run by or what the ultimate agenda of Epoch Times or Guo Wengui might be, for example. You know, if they started to publish misinformation about Taiwan, that could have a really big impact on circumstances here. And then I think the sort of fourth phenomenon that you see is coordinated inauthentic behavior from accounts that have learned to imitate Taiwanese concerns and Taiwanese speech patterns. I mean, we're just lucky that they're pretty bad at it. that the way they write in Mandarin, even if they're using traditional characters, for example, sounds kind of funny. It doesn't sound like Taiwanese Mandarin. Or that they switch, if you just take a look at their account, you'll see that they're switching between simplified and traditional Chinese in a way that, again, like kind of Taiwanese accounts don't do, or that they have, they kind of have fake profile pictures, for example, or they never tweet or write Facebook posts about life in Taiwan, that these are probably not real kind of Taiwanese people behind these accounts, but that there was an instance of the American Institute in Taiwan's Facebook page, for example, they kind of inundated with like sort of pro-Trump messaging and MOFA coming out, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs here coming out and saying that some of these accounts were clearly bots. But that's another argument that I've tried to make, that avoiding kind of hyper-partisanship also makes Taiwanese people less vulnerable to being imitated by kind of ill-meaning Chinese government operations, for example. You know, that if the message from Taiwanese people is consistently that there is a way to, there is a way for every country in the world to have better relations with Taiwan. There is space for Taiwan in multilateral organizations if the message is always that there are specific policies that can help Taiwanese people, that Taiwanese are open to working with a range of political actors, and that support for Taiwan is not a partisan issue, then you know, Chinese bots kind of just have less to latch on to. Yeah, actually, if it's okay, if I can go back to maybe that first question, and then also something that you said just now, I would say in the case of Taiwan that Trump himself has supposedly said very unflattering things about Taiwan and very flattering things about Xi Jinping, the chairman of the Chinese Communist Party, for example, has not really spoken up for human rights in the kind of periphery of the Chinese state, whether that's in Xinjiang in the West or in Hong Kong. However, the Trump administration, even through the multiple cycles of advisors that he churned through during just 4 years in office, I would say there were many people, John Bolton, Matt Pottinger, for example, in the administration who labored on behalf of Taiwan, who were pretty knowledgeable about Taiwan. And so Trump himself as the president gets that credit. And so I think what Taiwanese people are responding to is something real, which is that the Trump administration expanded what political scientists would call like the Overton window, this range of what it is possible to think or to say or to do at any given moment in time. And in this case, for a US presidential administration to say, think, or do regarding US-Taiwan relations. And so I think for those who say that the Trump administration has been good for Taiwan, I think they have a strong case. And it kind of rests on four pretty significant points. One, high-level visits. So the Taiwan Travel Act was passed in 2018 to encourage officials at all levels of the U.S. government to travel to Taiwan to meet their Taiwanese counterparts here, and then vice versa, to allow high-level Taiwanese officials to more easily enter the United States and this is from the text of the act itself, to be treated with kind of appropriate respect for the dignity of their stations. So you had, for instance, Alex Azars, who is the Secretary of Health and Human Services, his visit in August of this year, which marked the first visit to Taiwan by a Health and Human Services Secretary, the first cabinet member to visit Taiwan in 6 years, the highest level visit by US cabinet officials since 1979. This is from the American Institute in Taiwan's webpage. That was followed in September by a visit by Undersecretary of State Keith Krach, to attend the memorial service for the late President Lee Teng-hui. You could really see Taiwanese officials on the ground, right, making the most of these visits. So Krach was on the ground in Taiwan for 48 hours. But MOFA issued the statement, said that he met with high-level government officials here, people from various sectors, held discussions with them on many issues, like all in the span of these 2 days. The second kind of point in this case, I think, is economic benefits. So this kind of so-called trade war between the US and China. So there was a UN commission on trade and development report, which found that Taiwan was the economy that benefited the most from this kind of first phase, the trade war between the US and China. But as with so many things in the US-Taiwan-China triangular relationship, the question is, what is the tipping point, right? At what point do, for example, deteriorating relationships or greater competition between the US and China, at what point does Taiwan benefit? At what point, what's the tipping point at which Taiwan might also start to suffer? So for example, TSMC, which is the world's leading chip maker, as a result of this trade war, is facing greater pressure from the United States to decouple from the Chinese company Huawei. So I think one thing I would want to emphasize for people who really care about Taiwan is that you don't want necessarily unstable relations between the US and China. You don't necessarily want relations that put Taiwan in, you don't want relations to deteriorate to the point where Taiwan is put in a more awkward spot, or for Taiwan to just be used as a kind of cudgel or a bludgeon against China. So I think the third point that the case kind of Taiwanese sort of wish for Trump policies to continue rests on arms sales. So according to the National Defense and Security Institute for National Defense and Security Research, which is based in Taipei, under Trump in 4 years, the US pledged to sell kind of dollar for dollar value as many kind of military weapons and technology to Taiwan as the Obama administration did in 8 years. And people in Taiwan remember, this is in 2011, that the Obama administration decided to cancel the sale of F-16 fighter jets to Taiwan. And there was criticism that this was done because of Chinese pressure on the US. And there have been, and I think the fourth kind of pillar of this case sort of rests on like gestures and statements of support. So the Tsai Trump phone call, the phone call that occurred between President Tsai Ing-wen and then President-elect Donald Trump in December 2016, and Mike Pompeo's very recent comments on the Hugh Hewitt radio show, which is that, you know, he said that it was important when we're talking about US-Taiwan-China relations to get the language right. And this was kind of the quote that was sort of plastered all over Taiwanese media here. He said that Taiwan has not been a part of China. So this kind of sort of historically, Taiwan has not been part of China. And he said in this part got less play, but I think it's also really important that Pompeo also said that, I think that this is in part bipartisan. The central understanding is that this, meaning this is a model for democracy, that the people who live on Taiwan, you know, that there's a kind of bipartisan understanding that democracy in Taiwan is something that both parties in the US support. So I guess if it's okay to just push back, I think that the Trump administration has done a lot for Taiwan. What the issue is, you know, who to sort of credit for this. And So I think that in some ways, people are talking past each other when they say, well, Trump doesn't really care about Taiwan. He might not, you know. I don't know that there's a lot of evidence that Trump really cares for anything besides himself. And so I think that is probably true. On the other hand, he did bring on board this kind of rotating team of people who had expertise in the Asia Pacific, who prioritized U.S.-Taiwan relations, who made kind of consistently very visible gestures of support for kind of just Taiwan's like place on the global stage. And so what I would say is that that's not necessarily correct to credit to Trump himself. It's not necessarily extrapolating that to say that a second Trump administration would be as good for Taiwan as a first one is. I think that's a very dicey, that's a dicey proposition given how quickly these advisors have been changed. So therefore, I don't know that a first Trump administration is necessarily predictive of what a second one would be like for Taiwan. I think what's at issue is that there is this debate about what it means to be good, you know, what is being quote good for Taiwan mean? And there's a disagreement between people in Taiwan, local, born and raised Taiwanese who live here, versus, for example, people, foreigners who study Taiwan for a living, diaspora like myself, who have limited experience living in Taiwan.
I think what's key here and a good topic that you bring up is how different U.S. politics looks from Taiwan versus in the U.S. And that for many people who are looking at the U.S. presidential election from Taiwan, you know, one person's core is another person's periphery. And it's very easy to say the only issue that we're going to pay attention to is the China issue, because that is what affects people in Taiwan the most as far as the Trump administration's policies. And not just the Chinese issue, but how the administration plans to handle the U.S.-Taiwan-China relationship. And that support on that issue from people in the United States or overseas who are maybe Taiwan watchers or China watchers can look like a wholesale endorsement of all of the policies of Trump. So when you hear pro-Trump, that might read as, okay, this segment of Taiwanese society is quote-unquote pro-Trump, which means that they have endorsed his handling of racial tensions in the United States, his handling of the COVID pandemic, his migrant policies, and you know, all the way down the list of some of the issues that are very key to the American presidential debate and sort of presidential discourse and political discourse, but that from Taiwan, maybe issues that the average person just doesn't really care about. And that the focus of what would be called sort of a pro-Trump sentiment, would you say is more just very narrowly focused on what are the issues that impact Taiwan? And that is the basis of what people are using to form their opinions.
I think that's a really good way of putting it. And I think people here feel that they know that they are under kind of constant existential threat, and that opportunities like the one that the Trump administration had presented for Taiwan are very rare. And so there's a sense that what I would say is this, I think that living under this kind of existential threat is very difficult psychologically. It's a very difficult way to live your life. And that existential threat, what's very difficult about calibrating it is being able to tell whether it's also an imminent threat. And so in some ways, like living under the status quo. So again, it kind of goes back to this question, I think, of like, what is good for Taiwan? What does that mean, right? And does this mean a sort of constant acceleration of the relationship between the US and Taiwan? Does it mean the preservation of the status quo? Does it mean a US that voices support for Taiwan, that sends high-level visitors, that makes arms sales, regardless of what the US is doing kind of in its own house? Or does it mean a US that is itself kind of healthy, economically flourishing, governed with a steady hand, and that could potentially, therefore, maybe be more able and willing to kind of marshal multilateral support for Taiwan, even to aid in Taiwan's military defense should that need arise? And so I think that's kind of this cleavage. And so you have people who are, they're all kind of pro-Taiwan, and they all want, they all agree that this is a very unjust situation, that Taiwanese people have to live in this type of diplomatic purgatory through no fault of their own. And how to correct that, and whether the kind of quick pace that the US has upgraded relations with Taiwan under Trump, whether that's sustainable, whether that's something that ultimately is maybe at a pace that is too accelerated, for example. So I think that these are the terms of the debate. And I think that I would sometimes myself watching this debate, looking at it, observing it, sort of be frustrated by hearing people say, well, Trump doesn't really care about Taiwan. And that's possibly true. I think it's very likely to be true. But that isn't necessarily the most relevant metric here. And it's not, it hasn't, Taiwanese people are already used to not being cared about. And so whether or not Trump himself personally cares, whether or not Trump himself personally denigrates Taiwan, if his administration will make the types of verbal and actual kind of concrete gestures that they think are, creating more international space for Taiwan, that is really, I think, what is at issue here.
So building off of this topic, I want to then take this and pose the question, is there any reason to believe that this might change? Because I think that one thing that has been very difficult over the course of the Trump presidency is separating the person of Trump himself from the workings of the government and from the Republican Party. And you bring up a lot of great points there in that whether or not his personal views, he's certainly, an outlier in terms of US politicians, and whether or not his personal views on Taiwan situations really are, as you say, the best metric to really judge this by. And to take into account the way that historically the Republican Party has been seen to be more anti-communist, more pro-democracies, more interventionalist, and certainly seen to be more pro-Taiwan. And I want to talk about the concerns that people have about the end of the Trump era, and specifically, I mean, people in Taiwan. We know the results. There are legal challenges, obviously, but they're not expected to go much farther. There is some worry that a Biden administration, as you said, could have a more conciliatory posture towards China compared to some of the more adversarial policies under Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo. Do you feel, though, that there is reason for people to be concerned that the gains that have been made up to this point might be lost because of this?
I would say two things. One, that I understand these concerns and where they come from, but that nonetheless, I hope that Taiwanese Americans, our allies, won't turn away from the opportunities that may be present under this new administration or stop trying to capitalize on the gains the last 4 years. I think that people in Taiwan know that they've achieved a new level of international visibility under the Trump administration, that it's done more than its predecessor to help Taiwan secure its own defense. So I think just as a matter of like rhetoric, it's not particularly helpful. I think the tack of some progressive activists was to try to say, well, the Trump administration hasn't actually been good for Taiwan, or that Trump doesn't really care about Taiwan. And I think those are not particularly useful frameworks for approaching the subject. I would say it makes a lot of sense that the return of the same advisors who oversaw Barack Obama's foreign policy, can be disappointing or alarming to people in Taiwan, that it's logical that people who live here or are very, pay attention a lot to Taiwan politics, that they are kind of not going to be reassured by words alone. So all of that, I think, is very, very logical. But I would say that there's two things here, right? That this is the reality, this is the outcome of the US election. And so that I hope the response of the grassroots level in Taiwan can be to, one, accurately learn the record of presidential advisors, like, for instance, Antony Blinken, who recently been confirmed to be Biden's nominee for Secretary of State. He served as Deputy Secretary of State under Barack Obama. So he met, for example, with Tsai Ing-wen at the U.S. State Department in 2015. In testimony before the U.S. before the U.S. House of Representatives Foreign Affairs Committee in April 2016, so just before Tsai took office here, he stated that, we want to make sure that Taiwan cannot be coerced into doing things against the will of its people. We take very seriously that Taiwan must feel confident if it is to engage from a position of strength with the mainland. He also recently commented to Bloomberg that if China is getting signals of impunity, then one's concern is that it may think it can do the same with regard to Taiwan as it has with Hong Kong. So these comments, of course, aren't predictive of U.S. foreign policy, but along with the 2020 Democratic Party platform, they do foreground the wishes of the Taiwanese people. I think Taiwanese are often asked to be the bigger person in this very unfair geopolitical situation that they've been consigned to, and to overlook past slights. And that is a difficult situation to be in, and it has to be grating. But I think that Taiwanese people have more ability to affect the perception of their situation than is commonly recognized. And so that right now in 2020 starts with being honest, I think, about the steps that Biden's advisors have taken to speak up for Taiwan and to try to improve upon their past record. So that kind of segues, I think, into the second point, which is that we've got limited energy, got limited attention span from the audience that's out there, and that it should be used, right, to advocate for concrete policies that will kind of hold, for instance, Antony Blinken to the statements that he's made in support of Taiwan. So to speak about the policies that will help, quote, make sure that Taiwan cannot be coerced into doing things against the will of its people. So I think a lot of this is how we tell this story. So for example, Xiaobi Kim, who is the U.S. The Taiwanese representative to the United States, you know, made a post on Twitter or Facebook about the fact that she had spoken a 15-minute phone call with Antony Blinken. And, you know, of course, this is going to come as a disappointment to people whose expectations had been raised by the Trump-Tsai phone call in almost exactly 4 years ago. And so in the comment section, for example, and this sort of gets into the issue of kind of misinformation, there were a lot of non-Taiwanese accounts kind of in the comment section, what appeared to be non-Taiwanese accounts kind of spreading misinformation about the outcome of the US election, mixed in with complaints from what appeared to be genuine Taiwanese accounts about the Democrats' kind of past record, Obama administration specifically, their past record on Taiwan. And to me, this is a missed opportunity to reframe the narrative, to say that the story is that through two transitions of power in the United States, top US officials have spoken to top Taiwanese officials, that we're glad for this, and that this is the expectation that should be set going forward, so that no matter who comes into power afterwards, that there will be a repeat of this, and that this will be confirmed kind of visibly and publicly, that there are these direct contacts between high-level officials on both sides. I think about Taiwan is the subject of so much misinformation and targeted, coordinated disinformation campaigns, and what Taiwanese people and Taiwanese Americans and allies can do is to, again, like, we all have social media accounts, we all have contacts in the real world that we can talk to, and so do we use that space to discuss again past slights, which again are real, you know, they have left scars and marks, or do we use that space to say, okay, these are the things that we would like to see happen concretely? So here I'm drawing from Mike Mazza, who's a senior non-resident fellow at the Global Taiwan Institute, his recommendations for what he would like to see the Biden administration do kind of in the first year. And so, for example, that prioritizing for the new State Department to prioritize holding the second iteration of the Economic Prosperity Partnership Dialogue. So the first meeting was just held this month, November 2020. And so Mike says that by kind of dispatching even a kind of undersecretary, even an acting undersecretary, would show to people in Taiwan and to all observers watching, that this Biden administration is going to take advantage, for example, of the Taiwan Travel Act, which again was passed in 2018 under Trump, but that Biden is going to continue this policy, and that it's going to take steps to improve kind of economic cooperation with Taiwan, even if this is short of the bilateral free trade act that the Tsai administration has been angling for a long time. So that, like, what do we as Taiwanese people or Taiwanese Americans or as allies do with our voices? And I think there's a situation in which Taiwanese people feel that there is nothing that they can do, which again also helps to explain like Trump's kind of strongman appeal here. But I would argue that, especially given the flood of lies about Taiwan that people have to wade through daily, that anything that we can do to improve the quality of information out there about Taiwan, that anything that we can do to show that improved relations with Taiwan You can take limited concrete steps that will have an impact, that will not lead us to war, that are within this kind of status quo framework, but still moving towards normalization for Taiwan and its greater kind of participation in the public sphere.
I love that we're getting into all these different perspectives here, because I think that everybody is coming at this from a specific view. And I think that the comments that you've made really help to center the perspective of the Taiwanese experience. And I think that especially for a Western audience, it can be very difficult, as you said, to put ourselves into the shoes of living under what is an existential crisis, and how that can really shape one's sense of politics and international politics as a whole. And I want to continue in sort of talking about the different perspectives that people are coming at this from. I know that you said earlier that people tend to talk past each other, and labels like pro-Trump or anti-Trump or pro-China or anti-China get thrown around a lot for people who in a lot of ways are seeking similar goals or who have similar viewpoints on things. And switching from the way that this situation looks from a Taiwanese perspective, I want to talk a little bit about the way that this situation looks from an Asian American, and specifically a Taiwanese American lens as well. I know that you said that for many people who are part of the diaspora, that this also changes, specifically because in looking at things like the state of Western politics, the state of capitalism, the state of neoliberalism, there are many people who are very disaffected with the way that the United States is handling its place in the world. Specifically over the course of the Trump administration, there has been a ratcheting up of very harsh anti-China rhetoric. This has led in a lot of ways. We saw, especially during the outbreak of the beginning stages of the outbreak of the pandemic through the later stages, a lot of anti-Asian American hate crimes on the rise. And this has really affected a lot of the discourse around the way that people talk about Taiwan, China, et cetera, within the Western context. There's been recently a lot of groups who have emerged who have taken a very uncritical view of the Chinese state because of their dissatisfaction with the imperialistic attitudes of the U.S. And this can be, you know, this range of anything from being against the protest movements in Hong Kong to completely, you know, pro-annexation of Taiwan. And from your perspective, as we kind of shift to a more Western lens, what do you think are the root causes of these divisions amongst the Asian American communities, the Western Asian diaspora communities? And then what impact do you think that they have on what we've been talking about specifically in the view of Taiwan and Taiwanese Americans?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And so I would say for those of us who are also active in kind of generically Asian American organizations and spaces, it's a very common experience that they are dominated by people who identify as Chinese American. And this is just kind of demographic reality. And so it can often be the case that Taiwanese identity and concerns are sidelined or even belittled. And so Taiwanese Americans, I think, often have this experience of being asked for our solidarity, but then not being offered any in return. And so it is consistently still surprising to me, or not even surprising, I would say, but disappointing, that in like the early 21st century, that oftentimes the places where you will find Taiwanese concerns and identity being the most belittled or sidelined is in Asian American or Asian diaspora spaces. And so I think that's one part of this. I keep coming back to there's an excellent article by Terry Nguyen, this published just this weekend for Vox, on the phenomenon of misinformation in the US election in Asian American communities. And one of the points that she makes in this article that I think is a really important one is that Asian American is this incredibly broad umbrella.
I read that article and it was a fantastic article. Yes.
Oh, great. Yeah. She asked if I could do an interview with her, and I was just like so busy with work. So I pointed her to Rath Wang. I don't know if you know him, but he helped to found like Taiwanese Americans for Progress, which like we can talk about a bit more later. But so I'm glad that she quoted him like at length, and I was like, oh, this is great. Like he's like a really good voice to have out there. But that Asian America is this very broad umbrella, and what it hides is that a lot of people belonging to it, who are kind of shoehorned into it, their home countries have different relationships with China, with the regional hegemon in Asia itself. And so when we're looking at these kind of new anti-new Cold War organizations that are coming in particular from a kind of left perspective, we see these organizations, for example, deny like the mass internment of Uyghurs in Xinjiang. We see them ally themselves with groups that support the Chinese government's coercive policies towards Taiwan, just to take kind of two examples. And that's kind of their internationalist perspective. And then in a US context, they'll say that what they're doing is trying to advocate for reducing racial stigma against Asian Americans by arguing that we shouldn't have a kind of cold or hot war against China. So you'll see these organizers claim to stand for all Asian Americans while transparently minimizing the suffering of several groups that fall within this broad category. I would argue, I think that two things, that advancing views in support of the Chinese government policies in Xinjiang or Tibet or Hong Kong or Taiwan. I don't see how advancing those views helps their stated goal of reducing racial stigma against Asian Americans. I don't see that these people, they say that they're for all Asian Americans, but Asian Americans have very different groups of Asian Americans have very different political concerns when it comes to the role that China is playing in the Asia Pacific. That's one thing. Two, and I would argue that a consistent anti-war policy would have to acknowledge and critique Chinese government's increasing military threats towards Taiwan as one of the flashpoints that's most likely to result in hostilities between the US and China. So I myself am not at all a hardliner. I would say that it seems counterintuitive probably for people who are very anxious about the possibility of a new Cold War. But I would argue that the more moral, diplomatic, and defensive military support that is offered now in favor of Taiwan's existing freedom The higher the cost is of invasion or blockade or some other kind of show of force for the People's Republic. And then the greater likelihood that Beijing will choose peace instead. So I would say abandonment of Taiwan or downplaying the very real military threat that China like loudly proclaims on the daily, right? That it intends to show to Taiwan if some indeterminate red lines are crossed. Would instead, I think, lead to a miscalculation on Beijing's part about how winnable a war of conquest could be, how quick a war like that might be, with kind of devastating consequences for people on both sides of the strait, with the possibility of that morphing into a greater regional Trans-Pacific conflict. So I think it's not enough to concentrate on what the US needs to do to reduce tensions without, especially as an Asian American group, without also paying attention to what is taking place in Asia.
You've talked before on your Twitter account, for example, about a lot of these politics coming from places of trauma. And I think it's interesting that you bring up, for example, some of the ways that trauma has shaped some of the older generations of Asian American voters, for example. And then as well, some of the traumas that maybe younger generations of Asian Americans who have grown up in a Western context might be feeling towards the state of Asian America. And I think, unfortunately, there tends to be a flattening of this debate into something of a zero-sum game where, you know, to support more racial equality in a Western context, that you necessarily have to support the Chinese government or to support the, for example, something like the determination of Hong Kong or Taiwan, that you have to be not willing to critique racial policies in the US. And I think that there's a lot of nuance that is really mm-hmm. lost in that debate. And I think one of the things that New Bloom really tries to do is to carve out a space in that leftist perspective of a way that we can be critical of imperialist policies. And like you said, to take note of where there are real threats of violence, military intervention on either side. And that's something that I think that unfortunately has been lost a lot in this debate. And to bring us out to the close here, we've talked about a lot of perspectives today about the state of the US, China, Taiwan, and some of the conflicts. And specifically talking about the Asian American context, as the new administration comes in, it will be some time before we see what their policies towards China, towards Taiwan are. But do you think that there might be hope for reconciliation between some of these viewpoints over time, or do you think that divisions will continue to deepen?
So one area that I think I would really like to see people work on this individually or collectively is sort of improving the connections and the flow of high quality information between people based in the US and Taiwan, between academics and researchers on the one hand, and then their potential readers on the other, between first and second generation diaspora, even between sort of 1.5 and second generation diaspora, to sort of better understand what the US has been doing for Taiwan, no matter what administration is in power. For those who study or work on Taiwan, to kind of better understand what people in Taiwan want. So if I can just give a few quick shout outs, definitely to independent news outlets like New Bloom, like Ketagalan Media, that have really stepped up to try to make Taiwan more accessible to English language audiences. And also, as you say, to try to explain to Taiwanese audiences, for example, you know, that I think there's a tendency here to think that the United States is in some ways like invincible, that US power is an unqualified, is sort of an unqualified good also. And I think that bilingual outlets that try to reach out to a younger generation of readers on both sides of the Pacific play a really vital role here. I didn't have anything like this when I was growing up. My own like Mandarin reading skills have improved a lot in my 30s, but I really wish that I had a resource like New Bloom available, like Ketagalan available when I was in college, for example. So there are, I think there's a lot of tension between local Taiwanese and Taiwanese, especially primarily English speaking Taiwanese diaspora. And again, I hope that this kind of anxiety about Taiwan's future can be channeled in productive directions towards joining, for example. So I mentioned before Taiwanese Americans for Progress, which was recently founded. So these organizations kind of span the political spectrum in the US. Some of them are totally nonpartisan as well. So Taiwanese Americans for Progress, as its name implies, you know, wants to harness the energy of Taiwanese and Taiwanese diaspora. So it's so far got people who are kind of 1.5 generation and second generation. So people who were born, partially raised in Taiwan, and then people who were born and raised in the US to try to reach out to especially new democratic politicians to try to explain, you know, why Taiwan matters. There's American Citizens for Taiwan, also the Formosan Association for Public Affairs, which helped to establish both the Taiwan caucuses in both the House of Representatives and Congress. And it's been working since 1982 to advocate for Taiwan on Capitol Hill. So I think about all the great academic work that is being done on Taiwan and also kind of research about Taiwan and the space that exists to, again, kind of offer Taiwan more diplomatic, moral, economic, defensive support that still exists within this kind of longstanding framework of wanting to keep peace on both sides of the strait and regionally in Asia. So work that's being done by various think tanks in Washington, by various academics who write for a public audience. And what you can see, I think, is a lot of that, which again comes with kind of concrete recommendations for specific policies, that sort of doesn't filter down to like more ordinary discourse here. It doesn't kind of get translated as much in the media here in Taiwan. And I think that could be really helpful so that people know, okay, if I want to improve US-Taiwan relations or I want to raise Taiwan's visibility on the international stage, what are the policies and the proposals that you could potentially get people on board for, that you could build kind of bipartisan, multipartisan, multilateral, multinational kind of coalitions around. And because I think a lot of this comes back to whether we act from a position of believing that there is something that we can do to buy Taiwan space and time and breathing room, or if we're kind of stuck in this spiral of this is an impossible situation and there's nothing to do but just sort of worry.
Well, thank you for coming on the episode today, Catherine. That was a lot of great material. I'm very excited for our listeners to hear. Absolutely. Before we let you go, is there anything else that you would like for our audience to know?
I would say that if there's anyone out there who wants to learn more about Taiwan, wants to advocate for Taiwan, there are so many people and organizations out here doing that work. And so you can find people who are your allies, who will teach you and guide you, who will be so glad for your energy and your time, and that it's never too late to learn. I kind of came back to this in my 30s, and it's been like an immensely eye-opening and rewarding experience. So, yeah.
That's all for today. I'd like to thank our guest Catherine Cho for coming on the show, as well as the rest of the Radio New Bloom team, Brian Hui, Nick Haggerty, and Yu Chen Lai. Until next time, I'm your host, Garrett D., and thank you for listening to Radio New Bloom. Good night, Taiwan.